It's time to proceed now with Harry Martin's blockbuster series on the Zodiac case. And in the fourth of these articles, Harry really begins to delineate the hard connections in a big way. Now, once again, the main name here, the most important name, is a woman named Darlene Ferrin, F-E-R-R-I-N, killed on July 4th, 1969. With her was another name to remember here, a fellow named Michael Magoo. I'm not sure how that's pronounced, M-A-G-E-A-U. He was shot and seriously wounded with her. He has changed his story and his identity many times and has been in hiding, currently believed to be living in Southern California. Also remember the name Paul Stein, S-T-I-N-E. Paul Stein and Michael Magoo and Darlene Ferrin and the suspect lived in the same rooming house for a time in 1966, and it should be noted that this was near the Presidio. And that's one of the many connections here. There are also some apparent occult connections, whether or not they are significant, and I expect they are. Also the possibility that Darlene Ferrin may have been into drugs and money laundering. And we're going to see, too, there's been some extraordinary legal maneuvering in this case, almost unthinkable under the circumstances. The following article appeared in the Napa Sentinel of Friday, November 8th of 1991. This story, once again copyright Napa Sentinel by Harry Martin, is headlined, "Several Witnesses Identify Photo of Zodiac Suspect," and it reads as follows. Law enforcement officials who have studied the Zodiac case but not worked directly with the investigation indicate that the case was terribly bungled, with each police jurisdiction jealously guarding their own leads and focusing on their own subjects. The only high marks given any investigator on the case was given to retired Napa Sheriff's Captain Ken Narlow, N-A-R-L-O-W. According to these law enforcement officials, one of whom is currently still in police work, the law enforcement agencies failed to fully cooperate with other agencies, thereby isolating murders within their own jurisdiction. Because of this lack of concentrated cooperation, many major clues were overlooked. The police were looking for a madman, a serial killer who randomly murdered his victims. Each law enforcement agency has its own prime suspect or suspects. Hundreds of names were brought forward, but in the search for Zodiac, no significant background checks were made of the victims, who they were, or who they associated with, and what links they might have had with other victims. The murder of Darlene Ferrin, F-E-R-R-I-N, on July 4th, 1969 in Vallejo, will unlock the clues to the entire Zodiac mystery, but when finally solved, it will not reveal the murderer of nearly 50 victims. It will only account for less than 10, including a victim not even listed in the local Zodiac files. That is the murder of Dana Lull, L-U-L-L, in 1974 in Las Vegas. It may also prove that Zodiac was not working alone all the time. And I would indicate that there are a number of pieces of information pointing to the Zodiac as not being alone at all. Witness the previous article from November 5th. It listed a lot of very interesting facts which are very thought-provoking and which directly challenge, if not overwhelm, the lone nut theory. Continuing with Harry's article from Friday, November 8th of 91. To understand the Zodiac, it is vital that the investigator understand Darlene Ferrin. Without knowledge of her lifestyle, the clue to the Zodiac would never be revealed. Darlene knew a terrible secret, and it is probably because of that secret that she was murdered, not randomly, but deliberately and with malice. Darlene's murder was most likely planned and executed by a person she knew very well, a person who she was very familiar with, a person who brought her gifts, a person who visited her place of employment and even her home. In fact, the murderer is believed to be a man who attended a party at Darlene's house. He was an uninvited guest and mingled with three Vallejo police officers who were also in attendance. Ironically, it was one of those officers who would have seen the murderer face to face without realizing it, who was the first policeman on the scene of Darlene's shooting. I would add here, I don't know if Harry is being ironic when he says, ironically, there may be more to it than that, but that last sentence again, for what it's worth, ironically, it was one of those officers who would have seen the murderer face to face without realizing it, who was the first policeman on the scene of Darlene's shooting. As we're going to see, there are an awful lot of, quote, coincidences, unquote, in this particular case, far too many to be accepting these as coincidences. The suspect drove a light-colored car during the time that Darlene knew him, and the day after she was murdered, he traded the car in at a San Francisco auto dealer. But let us trace the history of Darlene Ferrin, who she was, and what happened to her. Darlene lived in Vallejo and graduated from Hogan High School. After graduation, she went to San Francisco to work with a telephone company. Next connection is very important. Darlene lived in a boarding house type facility. According to Darlene's family, that boarding house or residential hotel was on Eddy Street, E-D-D-Y. Also, briefly living there was Paul Stein, a yellow cab driver who was also considered to be a Zodiac victim. Recall in earlier articles, we noted that Paul Stein knew Darlene Ferrin very well and that she was a frequent passenger in his cab. Continuing, the suspect was associated with the residential hotel in San Francisco on Eddy Street. Darlene's first husband was a resident of the residence hotel. Recall that in the first of the articles we read, we noted that Darlene's first husband was associated with the Presidio. Continuing, it was through this facility that Darlene met Michael Magoo, M-A-G-E-A-U, the man who was also shot on the night of July 4th, 1969. Stein later moved to Cole Street in the Haight-Ashbury. Darlene and her husband moved to Vallejo. Magoo also moved to Vallejo, and the suspect eventually moved to Balboa Street in San Francisco. So at this rooming house, we have three apparent victims of the Zodiac Killer: Paul Stein, Darlene Ferrin, and Michael Magoo. Magoo survived. Darlene's first husband, who was associated with the Presidio in this house is near the Presidio, and the suspect. Very important connection. We'll come back to it later. Continuing with Harry's article. Though Darlene was into the occult and may have belonged to a satanic or witch's coven, it was probably not the reason for her death. Whatever she practiced in the occult, she did not seem to take the entire thing seriously. However, her practice in the coven was associated with San Francisco and not necessarily Vallejo. A robe similar to those used in rituals associated with these organizations was found in the back of her closet in San Francisco by a family member. There has been a lot of speculation concerning satanic associations with the Zodiac, particularly since his letters are suggestive in that manner. But it is possible that Darlene did have an association with several people intertwined in the Zodiac investigation that participated in similar rites. But all trails associated with the coven relate to San Francisco and not Vallejo. By the way, I'll interject very briefly. There are people who call themselves witches who should not be interpreted as being satanic, although some of these, you know, witches also intersect with satanic practices. It should also be noted that organizations like Wicca, occult organizations, are frequent recruiting grounds for explicitly satanic groups. But I want to draw that distinction. Otherwise, I'm going to get a lot of silly expletive deleted during the phone-in session. Continuing. So basically, we've seen that Darlene was into the occult, whatever that nature, and that some of the other people that she was associated with may have been also. Whether that, those occult practices were a front for something else remains, as I like to say, food for thought and grounds for further research. We will pursue that in just a second. Continuing with the article, was Darlene into drugs and money laundering? Her associations with the Crocker Bank and her late emergence into some money cast a suspicion on the legitimacy of her activities. Darlene used layaway plans and did not buy expensive clothes. She only had her salary as a waitress. She was generally chubby and wore braces, but in the last months of her life, she lost a lot of weight, became very attractive, and suddenly could afford very expensive clothes and jewelry, at least expensive compared to her former lifestyle. She was able to purchase a home, but strangely enough, that house was under her name and her father-in-law's name, not her husband's. And this is odd. She was able to purchase a home, but strangely enough, that house was under her name and her father-in-law's name, not her husband's. Though Darlene was married a second time, she was anticipating a divorce and commenced to date, quote-unquote, other men, including several police officers. She was very outgoing and friendly. Note that she dated police officers. She had one frequent caller, a man who made her very nervous. He was a man that she warned her family not to talk with. She said she witnessed this man kill someone. Was the person Sherry Joe Bates in Riverside on October 30th, 1966, the night of a satanic ritual? The answer to that question appears to be no. I would note in this context that October 30th of 1966 is very close to Halloween, a satanic holiday, and that satanic rites, often involving murder, are performed within the several days of these holidays. Continuing. The man who may have killed Darlene and shot Magoo was known by the two victims. He has been described by many witnesses, including family members, as a man wearing horn-rimmed glasses, wearing a medical alert bracelet, ambidextrous, and smoking Pall Mall cigarettes. The man also had only half a smile because part of his face was partially paralyzed from a cement truck accident. He was 41 years old at the time. He had short, curly, light brown hair in a crew-cut style and a round face. The man was about 195 pounds and about 5 feet 8 inches tall. The suspect brought presents to Darlene's house, including cloth for a dress, a silver buckle, and what is believed to be money. The packages were generally left on the doorstep of Darlene's house, but on one occasion her sister was given the package. The sister had visited with this man at Terry's restaurant in Vallejo, where Darlene had worked, and he was at a house painting party in Darlene's home. Darlene is quoted as stating the following to her sister on February 27, 1969, 127 days before she was killed. Quote, "I guess he's checking up on me again. I heard he was back from out of state. He doesn't want anyone to know what I saw him do. I saw him murder someone." Unquote. Another quotation on Saturday, December 21st, 1968, the day after David Faraday and Betty Lou Jensen were murdered on Lake Herman Road. This, quote, "This is scary. I knew the two kids who were killed on Lake Herman Road. Yeah, I'm not going up there again," unquote. I would note in passing also that December 20th and is the day before December 21st of 1968, another satanic holiday. Continuing with the story, Darlene changed emotionally after the Faraday-Jensen murders. People close to her noticed a nervousness, a concern. She was scared of the man in the horn-rimmed glasses after he returned from out of state in February of 1969. She didn't want people near him, she was not too friendly with him, yet he hung around her, brought her presents, and lavished his affections on her. We know she was afraid of him because she witnessed a murder he committed, according to her own words. But it was a murder she did not report, and yet she had many friends who were police officers. The suspected murderer also knew Magot because of past relationships in San Francisco and also through his contacts with Darlene. One of Darlene's sisters has stated that Jensen was once a babysitter that Darlene used. There is no knowledge of how she knew Faraday, who was much younger than Darlene. When Jensen said, when Jensen and Faraday were found dead on Lake Herman Road, shot to death, the heater in their car was still on, and yet the window was rolled down on that cold December night. This suggests that a conversation between the people in the killer's car and the victims had taken place. No one claimed credit for the Jensen and Faraday murders, not at first. But after Darlene's murder, the Zodiac took credit for both sets of killings. One senior police officer not directly related to the case, but who has done extensive investigation on the Zodiac, suggests that Darlene and the Zodiac suspect were on Lake Herman Road on December 20th, 1968. One more time, because this is very important. One senior police officer not related directly to the case, but who has done extensive investigation on the Zodiac, suggests that Darlene and the Zodiac suspect were on Lake Herman Road on December 20th of 1968, that Darlene may have had a conversation with Jensen at the scene. The murder that Darlene would have witnessed, according to this veteran police officer, would have been Faraday. She had indicated she saw a man killed, quote unquote. Jensen fled the scene and was shot outside the immediate vicinity of the victim's vehicle. So according to the information presented here, Darlene, Farron, and the suspect may have been up on Lake Herman Road where Faraday and Jensen were killed, and that in fact this may have been the killing she witnessed. This is December 20th, 1968. Continuing with the story, Darlene had indicated that a big story would break in the newspapers around July 5th, 1969. Quote, "A really big story," unquote. She related that in the same concept as the information about witnessing the murder. What was Darlene talking about? It is believed that she was going to expose this man for the murder she saw him commit. There are no records that indicate she went to the police or to the newspaper, but the threat was there. She had an argument with the suspect in the restaurant parking lot hours before she was killed, and the suspect followed her and Magot to the scene where they were both shot. One more time, she had an argument with the suspect in the restaurant parking lot hours before she was killed, and the suspect followed her and Magot to the scene where they were both shot. So apparently, at least according to the information presented here, Darlene was arguing with the suspect, who then followed them to the point where she and Magot were both shot. Magot not fatally, Farron fatally. Bear in mind that Magot and Farron and the suspect and Farron's first husband and Paul Stein, another of the apparent Zodiac victims, all lived in the same rooming house near the Presidio. Continuing. This suspect returned to San Francisco and on the day after the murder traded in his car. The license number is known. The suspect disappeared, but not before writing a letter to the newspaper claiming credit for Darlene's murder and the murder of Faraday and Jensen. Darlene was probably killed for two reasons. First, she was a witness to a murder and was threatening to reveal it. And second, she continued to reject the man's advances toward her, and he could not handle that rejection. I would indicate that I do not necessarily agree with this piece of analysis here. I suspect, I can't prove, but I suspect that much more lay beneath this association, possibly the drug laundering and or money laundering hints that were laid down earlier, possibly satanic cult connections here, and again, there's a possibility, a distinct possibility, in my opinion, of an intelligence and national security connection. Continuing about the suspect, the man was basically a loner most of his life, having a love-hate relationship with his mother. He also fit the exact same description as the man who killed Stein in San Francisco. Bear in mind the suspects, Stein, Darlene Farron, Michael Magot, and Farron's first husband, all lived in the same boarding house near San Francisco. Continuing, he also has direct links to other murders associated with the Zodiac, and even at least one that has never been publicly associated with the Zodiac. Darlene is the key to the Zodiac killings, and most of the original murders were centered on people she knew. Hers was not a random killing by a madman. The man is still alive, and according to one police official, may be still killing people, not as the Zodiac, but because he is now paid as a professional to kill people. This suspect also knew Donna Lass, L-A-S-S, another suspected Zodiac victim, who moved to Lake Tahoe with him and worked with the same company. The Zodiac killings as we know them have more to do with a lover and scorn than a crazy random killer. I would indicate once again, it certainly is not a crazy random killer, but I suspect there may be much more having to do with organized crime and or national security connections here. Continuing, law enforcement officials have been made aware of this suspect, and they consider the information extremely credible. Check this next point. I'm going to begin with that last sentence again. Check the next point. That's why I'm convinced there has to be a major institutional involvement here of some kind. Law enforcement officials have been made aware of this suspect, and they consider the information extremely credible. However, the detectives on the case were ordered by a judge to close the file on his case. An unprecedented legal order. That last sentence again. However, the detectives on the case were ordered by a judge to close the file on his case. An unprecedented legal order. Continuing. A handwriting analysis of the Zodiac and the suspect's writing was conducted by law enforcement experts. They indicate the handwriting cannot be discounted. Six photographs, all of different people, were presented to one of Darlene's sisters. She sobbed uncontrollably when she looked at one photograph. "It's over," she said, indicating that she could positively identify the man. She asked to see a photograph of the man smiling his half-smile. It was produced, and she has positively identified the man as the one who Darlene had indicated killed someone and the man Darlene was frightened about. One of the Vallejo police officers at the house painting party has also identified the man from the same photographs. The man's name has been repeated four times in the cryptograms the Zodiac sent. His photograph was also identified as a frantic man who fled Lake Berryessa on September 29, 1969, the date Cecilia Shepherd was stabbed. And this last point is fascinating. He also taught code in the military. Well, there are a number of very, very important and significant connections in this particular case. It is, I think, only too obvious at this point that this was not some sort of random killing, and this was not the work of a lone nut. There's a whole lot more going on here, nor do I believe the lover scorned analysis or level of analysis, because it's apparent that although there may have been a lover's scorn and that may have helped motivate the individual under the circumstances, that would not cause the judge to order the detectives to close the file on the case. That is absolutely incredible under the circumstances. Let's take a look at some of the important pieces of information that we can relate from the articles and this particular article that really sort of kicks off the whole series in a big way, because Darlene Farran is the key to the case. Now, we begin with this rooming house on Eddy Street near the Presidio. Darlene Farran lives there. Michael Magoo, who was shot with her in Vallejo, is living there. Paul Stein, whom she knew very well and who was killed near the Presidio, he's living there. The suspect lives there, and so does Darlene's first husband, who is associated with the Presidio. Now, we should note, as we looked at in the story of October 29th, 1991, that Paul Stein was killed at Washington and Maple Streets. That was an area that is near the Presidio, and that the rooming house in which he met Michael Magoo, Darlene Farran, Darlene Farran's husband, and also apparently the suspect, or if not met them, they were living in the same area, is also near the Presidio, where the Presidio child molestation case and Michael Aquino are also were located. Bear in mind also that Sherry Jo Bates was killed on October 30th, 1966. That's right around the time of a satanic holiday, namely Halloween. Satanic rites are performed within a few days of the holiday. It's worth noting that Sherry Jo Bates knew a female relative of the subject, the Sentinel subject, and lived about 1.5 blocks away. Bates was supposed to go to the library, the school library, with the friend. She was found dead with a note signed with the initials RH. The friend left school the next day and did not attend Bates' funeral. Her car was seen parked at Washington and Maple Street several years later in the same location where Paul Stein was murdered. And bear in mind also that, as I said, Darlene Farran's first husband associated with the Presidio. Now, the next major connection here that we saw was that Darlene Farran did have some sort of occult slash witchcraft slash possible satanic connections involved with her life, and that these may have had something to do with the death, although apparently she was not a witness to Sherry Jo Bates' death, which may have been associated with a satanic ritual. Bear in mind, again, Sherry Jo Bates killed it around the time of Halloween. Now, it's also been speculated here that Darlene Farran may have been involved in money laundering. Her association, her change of lifestyle and her associations with the Crocker Bank render questions about just exactly what Darlene Farran may have been involved in. It's one of the reasons I suspect organized crime and or national security involvement in the case. Now, the next fascinating aspect is that Darlene Farran knew both David Faraday and the Jensen woman, whose name is, I always forget her first name, she knew both Betty Lou Jensen, who were murdered in Vallejo. They were murdered, bear in mind, on December 20th, 1968, also right around the time of a satanic ritual. It is the belief of Harry here, obviously the implication is, that it was Darlene Farran's witness of the Faraday-Jensen murder that led to her killing, and we should also note that there are indications in this article that Darlene Farran and the suspect had a talk with Faraday. Jensen fled the car and was killed right afterward. Should also be noted, too, that the killing took place near Hyde. Both Darlene Farran and the Faraday-Jensen killings took place near Hunter's Villas in Vallejo, associated with property owned by the subject. We should also recall, too, that in the very first story we read, many of the Zodiac's patterns and methodology and hints came from the movie The Most Dangerous Game, which involves a fellow who goes around hunting people. I wonder whether perhaps the Zodiac killer might have enjoyed the pun with the Hunter's Villa. Sometimes these things are done. Sometimes a sick mind will do it. Sometimes the intelligence community will also drop little hints like this when they don't think people can really figure out what's going on. Now, bear in mind, once again, Jensen and Faraday killed on 12-20-68, right around the time of the winter solstice, again, a satanic holiday. And it should be noted, too, that Darlene Farran was killed on July 4th, 1969, and Michael Magoo was shot and critically wounded with her. Both of them were at the original rooming house with Farron's first subject and Paul Stein and the suspect that was near, once again, the Presidio. And bear in mind that Darlene Farran, said that a major story was going to break on July 5th of 1969. It's worth noting that she never went to the police with this story, although she knew many, many police officers. There are very firm indications that Michael Magoo may have known the killer, and he is still in hiding, and that he apparently has changed his story a number of times. There's also an interesting indication here that the suspect may still be doing killing as a professional. One of the most extraordinary aspects to this entire case is the fact that the detectives who were pursuing the case and who felt Harry Martin's and the Sentinel's information was very credible were ordered by a judge to close their files on the case. Now, that is absolutely mind-blowing. That is incredible. And that, to me, is the firmest indication of some sort of serious institutional involvement with this case, whatever it might be, national security, organized crime, or both, because as we've looked at in Radio Free America 24 and other shows, our national security establishment does employ organized crime in a number of capacities. It's worth noting, too, that just as Harry's story was breaking in the media, there was a fellow who came forward and said that his dead brother was actually the Zodiac killer, and I think the information presented here casts serious doubt on that case, on that assertion. I'm going to touch on that in a second. One of the questions I have about this revelation, or alleged revelation, is that I wonder whether the fellow who floated this may have actually been doing this to throw the investigators off of the trail of the Sentinel subject. Bear in mind, too, that as we've seen, the Sentinel suspect taught code in the military. We have seen many evidentiary tributaries running in the direction of the Presidio. I suspect there may very well be a national security connection, and that this may very well, that is to say the Zodiac killers, may very well have been an exemplar of Mabrosso's hypothesis concerning the California violences. And bear in mind, too, the Sherry Joe Bates connection that I highlighted earlier. Bear in mind that as Harry Martin was coming out with all of this information, a fellow came forward who purported that his dead brother, whose initials were not R.H., the Sentinel suspect is still alive, that his dead brother was in fact the Zodiac killer. Reading from the San Francisco Chronicle of Friday, November 1st of 1991, Harry's first series, first article, Bro, was on October 29th, 2 days before, also ironically close to Halloween. In the Bay Area Report, we find the following from Vallejo. Man says his brother was Zodiac killer. A lawyer said yesterday that his dead brother was the infamous Zodiac killer who killed at least six people in California, Nevada, and Oregon between 1966 and 1974. William L. Beeman, B-E-E-M-A-N, 70, who uses the pen name of Dr. O. Henry Jigalance, J-I-G-G-L-E-L-A-N-C-E, alleges in his book Jack the Zodiac that his 66-year-old brother, Jack S. Beeman, was responsible for the string of up to 37 murders that have never been solved. Jack Beeman died of lung disease in 1984. William Beeman said his softcover two-volume book, which he published himself, contains, quote, 101 points of circumstantial evidence which show that his brother was the mass murderer. He cited a number of other similarities between his brother and the Zodiac killer, such as writing characteristics, use of common expressions, knowledge of firearms, a violent nature, a hatred of women, and an obsession with astrology. But the obvious links between the victims and the Sentinel suspect aren't covered here, and there is absolutely no reason why, if this fellow's brother, whose initials were not R.H., was the Zodiac killer, why would the judge order the detectives who found Harry's information credible to close their investigation? That, to me, is absolutely the most firm indication of an institutional involvement. That is absolutely unprecedented and frankly, just amazing under the circumstances. Well, that concludes the first installment of Harry Martin's Zodiac series. I realize that there's a lot of information. It's dizzying. It's tangled. There are more articles to come, and I will do my level best to try and unravel these many, many threads and incredible... You talk about the octopus. Well, this isn't the octopus here. This is the sea anemone. An awful lot more, entanglements here. But I will do my best to unravel these as I access Harry Martin's series, and I strongly encourage other reporters and researchers to do what they can to interface with Harry on this. I suspect that with all of these Presidio connections that I spoke about and with some of the incredible indications of a cover-up, we're looking at something a whole lot more than a lone nut and a whole lot more than the passions of a man scorned.
We're going to proceed now with an article from the Napa Sentinel, and as a matter of fact, I do not have a date. on this particular article. It has a headline, but it does not have a date. Oh, yes, it does. Tuesday, December 3rd of 1991. I'm used to looking at the Napa Sentinels per se and not the press packet series, of which I have a copy here. But we're going to begin now by taking a look at a gruesome series of murders which took place in Sonoma County. Almost all of them were young women. Many of them had been sexually molested and or undressed, wholly or possibly. One of the things that we looked at in The Ultimate Evil was that certain satanic cults are used as fronts for a variety of activity, not only by organized crime elements, but also by elements of the national security establishment: assassination, drug trafficking, slave prostitution, kiddie porn, political blackmail. These are some of the activities that some of these cults serve as fronts for. One of the good points that Harry makes in this particular series is that both with the Zodiac killing and with the Manson family and process umbrella cult, the occult connections per se are simply used as a ruse, as a cover for sinister and altogether more temporal activities. There was a series of brutal murders in Sonoma County which have never been officially connected with the Zodiac killer, but they may have, or killers, I should say, Team Zodiac, because that is a central theme in Harry's series here. But I'm going to begin by taking a look at the Sonoma murders, because there is a similar M.O. in these brutal murders, almost all of them young women, and some of the M.O. used not only by the Zodiac killer, but also by the intersecting Manson family and process umbrella cult. Reading now from the Napa Sentinel of Tuesday, December 3rd of 1991, this article is entitled Zodiac, the Eerie Connections in Sonoma Murders, and it reads, "Before we zero in on Team Zodiac, the list of their victims, and the motive for their murder spree, we must examine a few more murders not necessarily claimed by the Zodiac, but perhaps very pertinent to the case. These murders have a curious connection with the suspected members of Team Zodiac. In 1970, the Zodiac wrote a letter stating he would no longer inform anyone of his new victims. This either meant that Team Zodiac had completed its pre-planned murders and would no longer create public attention, or that other murders would take place. Over four dozen murders have been investigated as potential Zodiac killings, but law enforcement officials say they can only attribute seven direct murders to the Zodiac. We disagree with the seven murders that law enforcement list. The listing of the victims was predicated on Zodiac notes claiming responsibility, but the Zodiac letters were not always truthful. They were written to deceive. The only two guaranteed Zodiac murders were that of Darlene Farron on July 4, 1969, and Paul Stein on October 11, 1969. Continuing, if Donna Lass, L-A-S-S, was murdered, and it is believed she was, that would have been a third murder that could be linked to this crime. The murders of Sherry Jo Bates on October 30, 1966, and Cecilia Shepherd on September 27, 1969, can also be directly related. The Sheriff's Department in Riverside County does not accept the concept that Sherry Jo Bates was a victim of the Zodiac. We believe the murders are connected. The murders of Betty Lou Jensen and David Faraday on Lake Herman Road have only been linked to the Zodiac because he provided full details of the murder site. According to a retired Vallejo police officer who investigated the case, the Zodiac letter did not contain any information about those murders that could not have been readily learned. The murders of Jensen and Faraday have no relationship to the Zodiac, and in fact, if the case was studied close enough, it would be learned that at least one Vallejo police officer was directly involved. Zodiac claimed after the Paul Stein murder that Stein was his seventh victim. But even with Jensen and Faraday, that only makes six murders. Without them, there are only four murders. A young couple was killed in Santa Barbara before the murder of Bates, a murder that the killer of Bates alluded to in a letter which stated she was not the first victim nor the last. The Santa Barbara murder was not witnessed by Darlene Farron, who would have been only 16 or 17 years old at the time of those murders. Yet Darlene witnessed the murder of a man. The murderer is believed to be the murderer. The murderer is believed to be the man who killed her. That would account for seven. All these murders happened on weekends, which ties in with the travel and schedule of some of the suspects in the case. But Team Zodiac killed for more than one reason. The first reason was to silence people around them that knew too much. Another aspect was to mislead law enforcement officials into believing a mad killer was on the loose. The final reason was pleasure, once the main task had been taken care of, and in some cases, rejection. There was a series of murders in San Francisco and in Sonoma County that might have a direct bearing on the Zodiac case, mainly because the victims or their bodies show a proximity to property and or relationships with the Team Zodiac. The murders in Sonoma County are attributed to a satanic concept. Many investigators attempt to link the Zodiac killings with the Process, an international satanic organization. One investigator is linking the Process, Zodiac, and Charles Manson into one plot. The closest thing that we can come to such a theory is that the Team Zodiac have direct links with organized crime. The national and international satanic groups are an element of organized crime dealing with drugs, prostitution, murder, and pornography. We will focus on the murders in San Francisco and Sonoma County. But first, Sonoma County. The Sonoma County killings all took place in 1972 and 3, 2 years after Zodiac went silent. Generally, we would dismiss these murders, but for an eerie connection that we will reveal. Maureen Sterling was 12 years old and Yvonne Weber was 13. They were classmates at a Santa Rosa junior high school. They vanished on a Friday night. Weekends were when all the Zodiac murders occurred, February 4th, 1972. The girls hitchhiked from the Redwood Empire Ice Arena. They met their boyfriends and then hitchhiked back to the ice arena. But they never came back. They got into a car on Guerneville Road. A month later, on March 4th, 1972, Kim Wendy Allen, a 19-year-old Santa Rosa Junior College student, was hitchhiking from San Rafael to Santa Rosa. She was found the next day dead, lying on an embankment 20 feet off Enterprise Road, a rural road east of Santa Rosa. She had died a horrible death, being slowly strangled for 30 minutes. She had been bound at the wrist and ankles. She was nude and had been raped. About 51 days later, Jeanette Kamehle, K-A-M-A-H-E-L-E, disappeared. She was a 20-year-old Santa Rosa College student last seen April 25th, 1972. Hitchhiking, there was a misprint there. I'll read that last sentence again. She was a 20-year-old Santa Rosa College student last seen April 25th, 1972, hitchhiking. She was seen climbing into a Chevrolet pickup with a wooden homemade camper in back. The driver of the vehicle was described as white, 20 to 30 years old, with light brown hair and an afro style. Lori Lee Cursa, K-U-R-S-A, 13, was the next to disappear. She was a runaway and a frequent hitchhiker. Her nude body was found on December 14, 1972, 50 feet down an embankment off Calistoga Road in Rincon Valley, east of Santa Rosa. Her neck was broken. 2 weeks after finding Cursa, K-U-R-S-A, the bodies of Maureen Sterling and Yvonne Weber were found off Franz Valley Road, F-R-A-N-Z. 7 months later, a motorcyclist traveling down Franz Valley Road found the body of 14-year-old Carolyn Davis of Anderson. She had been missing for 16 days. She also was hitchhiking down Highway 101. She was found within 4 feet of where Sterling and Weber were found. Teresa Walsh disappeared on December 22, 1973. She left Malibu and was heading home for the holidays. She was found on December 28th in Mark West Creek, east of Santa Rosa. Carolyn Davis was found on July 16, 1973. The Sheriff's Department feels that one person is responsible for the killings. Three of the victims were found on Franz Valley Road, adjacent to property owned by the California Academy of Sciences. One body was found on Mark West Road, adjacent to property owned by the California Academy of Sciences. But there is more, much more. Though the killings do not follow the regular pattern used by Team Zodiac, the warning note of Zodiac is that they would die in different ways. The Sonoma County Sheriff's Office believes these murders to be tied to Satanism, but we don't. We will identify the ownership of other property near where the bodies were found. But before that, it is important to explore links in the San Francisco slayings. It is the links in the case, more than the type of killings, that begin to weave a comprehensive pattern. Now, one of the reasons why I went into this particular article in this massive 28-part series is that there, as we shall see, are some distinct similarities in the M.O. between the Sonoma County murders and some of the Manson family Process umbrella cult murders that took place in Southern California. Not only were the vast bulk of the victims young women, but the brutal manner in which they were stabbed and the fact that they were thrown physically into ravines indicates a great deal of physical strength on the part of the killer. One of the things that we looked at in our series on Satanism, mind control, and the national security establishment, again, is that some of the activities that some of these satanic cults are used for by the intelligence services and military that co-opt them, and thus in some cases create them, they are used for not only assassination, they are used for drug trafficking, but various kinds of vice, in particular slave prostitution, the making of snuff flicks, kiddie pornography, and also a very closely related function, namely political blackmail. If, for example, you can beguile a political figure into engaging either in child pornography or into having sex with an underage woman or into participating in some sort of satanic ritual, and if you can film it, you then have a very powerful tool for blackmail, and at that point, that particular individual who has been so duped is essentially a tool of whoever has successfully duped him. It should be noted, too, that there is, unfortunately, a tremendous amount of resistance on the part of a great many people to even acknowledging that these sorts of things go on. I have heard people deny, for example, that snuff flicks are made, whereas, in fact, the creation of and trafficking of snuff flicks is a very well-documented phenomenon, and unfortunately one which is much more widely spread than a lot of people would like to acknowledge. For those people who may not be familiar with it, a snuff flick is a film in which someone is actually murdered on camera, almost always in a sexual context. There are most snuff flicks usually involve women, often young women, although young boys, young men are often filmed as well. There is also a homosexual market for snuff flicks. Incidentally, there was a cover story on the New York Times Sunday magazine last October of a feminist lawyer named Ms. Catherine McKinnon, who is attempting to track down some of these murderous pornography rings, the people who make snuff flicks and who otherwise torture and murder people, particularly women, in a sexual context. And she herself has met a great deal of institutionalized resistance, despite the fact that for someone who has studied the political underside of this country, such phenomena are quite well documented. Recall that in my interview last summer with Gunter Rusbacher, a naval intelligence and CIA operative who maintains he was one of the pilots involved in the October surprise, one of the operations he was involved in was something called Operation Clydesdale, in which there was a ring, a worldwide ring, of murderous pedophiles who would kidnap children, may use them for making various kiddie pornography films, and then murder them making snuff flicks when the children got too old. And this Operation Clydesdale involved Gunter and his naval intelligence compatriots taking out false ads in various Vice newspapers and luring the sinister individuals who were behind this activity into contacting them, at which point they were promptly dispatched without due process. Generally, I stand behind due process, but given the relative inability of law enforcement to curtail activities like this, I think at some point something does have to be done, and I basically would have to say that I sanction activities like Operation Clydesdale in that particular context, again, given the political protection that a lot of these elements have. One of the things that I would recall for long-time listeners is that during the Hillside Strangler case and the investigation of it, some of the young women, this was a case in which a large number of young women were found strangled to death and often sexually molested in Southern California. During the grand jury proceedings in April of 1980, two of the women testified that the particular operation in question was one being conducted by organized crime in conjunction with elements of law enforcement, that the women basically were told that either they did what they had to do and that it was a slave prostitution ring. If they resisted doing what they were required to do, they were killed and their bodies dismembered and shipped out of state. And there appeared to be a very strong involvement of elements of law enforcement. The two fellows, Kenneth Bianchi and Angelo Buono, who were convicted in the Hillside Strangler case, were described by one victim, or one lucky victim, I guess, who was able to stay alive and escape. They would drive around until they would see a woman they thought was attractive and get her license plate number, and then they would phone it in, apparently to friends in law enforcement, find out where she lived, and abduct her, and put her to work for them. Immediately after this information came out, the grand jury proceedings were barred from the press. The press was barred from the grand jury proceedings. So these kinds of activities do go on. They're not nearly as well documented as they should be. And one of the things that I would note
in connection with the Santa Rosa killings, not, or the Sonoma County killings, I should say, many of them in Sonoma. One of the things that I would note is that not only were the women often killed in a manner similar to the Manson family process umbrella cult killings, but in particular they were flung a great distance physically into ravines, many of them, indicating a tremendous physical strength on the part of the killer. This also is similar to the Manson family Zodiac MO that we will look at later.